All right. The Data Practices Subcommittee will come to order. Thank you, everyone. Just a little bit of a roadmap here. We hope and intend that this will be the last hearing for this subcommittee this year. So what we're going to do, and I'm glad Representative Kahn is here because I invoked her, as I do in other contexts yesterday, we're going to do this sort of the Phyllis Kahn method of legislating, which is to have things alive and as many places as possible, because some individual bills have to meet other deadlines. So we're going to pass all these bills out, as I announced yesterday, separately, but we're also going to do an omnibus, which we'll do at the very end. The vehicle bill will be my bill on libraries, which is non-controversial. Mr. Gehring has drafted amendments to all the bills that we will have passed, and we'll just slap those on at the end. And so we'll have both an omnibus bills, and we'll pass them out as individual bills. We're going to be a little unorthodox about the order here because of people's schedules. It's a Friday. I really do want to say I know these are pressing and important issues to a lot of people, but word economy is going to be important. Representative Winkler only half joked that we should offer pizza to people whose bills take a shorter time rather than longer. But I think, he says he wasn't half joking. But I think brevity is important. So we are going to start with Representative Scott's bill. Would you like to move your bill, Representative
Scott? Yes, I'd like to move House Bill 804.
Okay. Okay, recommended pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. Representative Scott.
In accordance with Section 1302, the Department of Corrections is allowed to gather data on felons that are incarcerated. However, they are not allowed to gather and collect data on probationed felons. This bill would allow them to collect this data as well from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The purpose for the collection of this data is to assist the Department of Corrections in evaluating their programs and their effectiveness in helping the offenders get jobs and keep jobs. And with me today is Mr. Grant Dewey. He is the Department of Corrections Research Director. He'll give some more specifics.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Previously, we have been able to have direct access to D data for offenders who have come into the prison system. And we've used that data to evaluate the effectiveness of employment and vocational programming to determine what works and what doesn't. And currently, we don't have that for probationers, but there is a similar need to assess the effectiveness of employment and vocational programming for those probationers who are in the community. And so having direct access to this D data would give us the capability of doing that.
Okay. Any members have any questions, concerns, comments? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Scott renews their motion that House File 804 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Scott. The next bill, and I'm mindful that we have some folks here. Representative Norton has informed us we're not going to do your bill next, but what we will do, Representative Myra's bill, let's face it, is somewhat complex. If we're going a little late here, we will reserve the right to lay that bill over so that we can take up the Norton bill so that the testifiers who are here from Rochester, as I understand, can get back in time, or they're at least they're here and have some time sensitivity. So we'll go to Representative Myra, and I guess I'll make the motion to I'll move that House File 604 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for hearing my bill. I have an author's amendment. That's the A3 amendment, and I'd like to go over that amendment, if I may.
A3, did you say?
A3.
Okay.
The A3 amendment puts the language back to its original statute on lines 2.1 through 2.6. The original language is put back in, and the new language is deleted.
Okay.
On line 310, the word chiefs is added after managers. At the end of 311, strike employee that and insert equivalent position. On line 312, all the new language is deleted. on line 314, directors, oops, no, assistant directors, excuse me, assistant directors or associate directors is struck. Line 315, the entire line is taken out. And on 316, evaluation or curriculum is removed.
Okay. Representative Meyer, before we take a vote on the amendment, I think it might be helpful for you to let me ask this.
Would you like me to discuss the bill?
I think you should discuss the bill and the history. I think a lot of people are looking at this. And also, will this be your only amendment?
That is my only amendment.
You offer? I know there are other amendments in the package.
There are other amendments. Okay. One is an outdated one that I submitted, and then there are two others.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, this originally came up last year as a result of a settle agreement that was done in a school district, 191, in my area, settling a dispute for over $250,000. And the school board wasn't allowed by statute to reveal very much information about that. There was an outcry of both taxpayers and parents for more information, because of course when there's a payout of that kind of sum, that means that those funds aren't able to be used for the many precious programs that we would really like to be doing in our schools. The bill last year passed unanimously in the legislature and was signed into law by the governor, and it went into effect May 5th. Since then, there have been a couple of situations that have drawn our attention that there were some loopholes and language that needed to be tightened. Particularly on page 3, the section or subsection III, it discusses who in a city or county would be considered a public official. And the language that was there and has been struck kind of talked more to administrative flowchart rather than getting at what we were really trying to achieve is management positions. And so that's why we took out the language reporting directly to the chief administrative officer, and then we've added those other definitions of what a public official is. On line 313, we added athletic director. There was a situation where something came up, and we realized that athletic director was not included in there, so we've added that as well. In my bill, I have struck line 319 through 324. There were two situations that came up, one in August and one more recently. The one in August was with the city of Minneapolis, and more recently the situation is Sibley High School. And the Department of Administration ruled that they were not considered, data did not need to be disclosed about those payouts or those situations because of what we added here in subsection F. When my bill originally passed unanimously from the House, it did not include this subsection F. It was added at the last minute in the Senate, and fearing that we wouldn't get the bill through because we were in the final days of the session, we just let it go, and unfortunately has shown to provide too many loopholes for what the spirit of the law is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Meyer, just as I understand that the language that you strike, starting on line 3.19 of the original bill, as I understand it, that sets up a separate standard for certain, it differentiates between state employees and employees of other units of government. Is that true, and can you explain?
That is true. The way the statute is right now is it's a two-tier system. The first tier has been in place for almost two decades and has worked well. And what we wanted to do last year is to expand the definition of public official, and so we included all these other areas. And then, like I said, this additional language was added there for those who are in cities, counties, or school districts. And it has proven to be, as one individual said, a loophole that you could drive a snowplow through. So that's why we're trying to take care of it today.
Okay.
Before we vote on the amendment, on the MIRA A3 amendment, are there any members who have questions or concerns? Or actually, maybe I should open it up right now to members of...
Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers. Should I have them come
sure.
now?
Sure.
All right.
Well, I'd read before we actually vote on the amendment, because there are other amendments that are kind of in competition, I'd like to hear from your testifier and then members of the public.
All right. Very good. Mr. Gemberling is here, and also Mr. Antonson.
Okay. Mr. Gemberling.
Maybe Mr. Amundson isn't here.
Mr. Chairman, Don Gemberling from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. And I don't think Mr. Amundson is here. Don't see him. So, we're in absolute support of what Representative Myra is trying to accomplish here. We were in absolute support of what she tried to accomplish last year. When the negotiations were going on in the other body, I saw the language that she's deleting on page 3, I strongly urged everybody involved not to accept that language, because every time you put something conditional into these situations, you give the government an opportunity to hop on the condition and continue to keep stuff away from the public. So. The kind of context here is, I'm reasonably sure, and I'm going to go a little bit out on a limb, much of what this has to do is people in government trying to avoid telling the public about embarrassing things that have happened in government, okay? And as Representative Myra has told you, some 20 years ago, you said embarrassing things that happen in state government and that involve high police public officials. We're going to tell the public about them, okay? And we're going to tell the public about settlement agreements in which large amounts of public money are being paid out. And at the time, some of us argued that it didn't make sense to have that only cover state government, but we didn't win that battle. But now I think you've come to understand through watching some of the things that have happened over the last 20 years, large settlements with public employees and no explanation of why they were getting money. That kind of thing has led Representative Myra and the House unanimously to say we shouldn't be doing that anymore. Okay, and we strongly support your position. Now, contextually, I want to say one thing, or actually two things. Remember, in the larger law of data praxis, once you declare data public, okay, no matter how embarrassing someone may feel that data is to them, if it's disclosed to the public, there is no liability whatsoever to the government for releasing that data. That's the way the law works. And if you want to look at the case that set down that principle, it's called Johnson versus Sturzwager. A state employee was accused of, quote, taking sexual liberties with patients under his care. Now, that's a pretty heavy-duty thing to say about somebody. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said that could be disclosed to the public, and as a matter of fact, the Department of what was then called Public Welfare, under the provisions of the Data Practices Act, had to disclose it to the public. And therefore, there was no liability under the Data Practices Act for that kind of disclosure. The second thing that you've done in the Larger Data Practices Act is you've given the authority to the Commissioner of Administration to issue advisory opinions. When you set up that authority, the carrot, as it were, that you offered to government was to say to them, if the Commissioner says in a given situation you ought to be releasing this data because it's public, and they subsequently release the data and somebody disagrees with the commissioner and sues that agency, they can't collect any damages, they can't collect costs, they can't collect attorney's fees, and basically it's a major disincentive to sue, okay? And I once did a training session with school attorneys, and I was happy to notice that one of the school attorneys got up and talked about the commissioner's opinion authority. It was fairly new then. And she said, you know, this is the cheapest insurance you can buy to immunize you from liability. It's cheap because it's free, okay? So when I read about things like the West St. Paul situation, part of what I wonder is, why didn't somebody ask for a commissioner's opinion about what they were doing before they did what they did? The commissioner won't do hypotheticals, but the commissioner will look at detailed situations and issue opinions, but that didn't happen. Instead, somebody wrote a settlement agreement that said basically, we entered into this agreement to avoid liability. Well, that is, to me, is not a specific reason. So urge you to adopt the Myra bill with its changes, and you'll be making a good blow for public policy and accountability in government, which is one of our hallmarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gamberling. I'd like to Representative Hulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if the DE amendment's being offered by somebody today. Is that, do we know, or?
Representative Hulbert, I don't know. We're right now, we're on the A3 amendment. Because it's a DE amendment, it's certainly possible that someone, if we were to act on A3, well, either way, if we voted up or down, someone could offer the DE. I don't know. No one's notified me about who's offering it, but they need not do that. So it's in our packets. I don't know who, under whose name, but it's in the packet. So, yeah, Resident Horton. Oh, okay.
Oh, yes.
Well, Representative Hortman, do you plan on offering it regardless of what happens here on the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, there's a testifier in the audience who can kind of address the issue. I don't know if you're going to go through opponents' testimony. I think there's a lot more to be said about the Myra bill before we get to my amendment.
Yes, Representative Hortman, I do want to entertain testimony on the amendment, which will inevitably sort of bleed into testimony on the bill. I understand that. There
Mr.
are a few
Chair,
moving
Mr.
parts
Atkinson
here.
Mr. Atkinson is here, maybe
okay.
testifying.
Sure. Mr. Why don't you make your way down, Mr. Atkinson? Representative Winkler.
Question for based on Mr. Gamberling's testimony.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead. Well, it's of Mr. Gamberling.
Go ahead. Maybe.
All right. We can always bring him back. Mr. Atkinson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Atkinson, I apologize for being late. I've been out negotiating with Plant Services on the two defective parking meters in the parking lot next door. So honestly, neither one works, and it's complicated. I appreciate your time. Not nearly as complicated, thankfully, as data practices policy. So thank you for your time. I'm not going to belabor my testimony this morning. Our association, which I represent, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Newspaper Association, I should make clear, strongly supports the bill. This basic same legislation, as you know, was enacted last year to serve a very specific purpose and a very important purpose, which is to shine light on some of the most vexing public issues that can occur at the municipal government level, which is large buyouts of government executives. And it turned out the legislation was flawed. So, as I understand the current bill, it's back to fix the problem, and the problem needs to be fixed, and we support the effort to do so. So, thank you.
Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if Mr. Anfinson can address this or if Mr. Gamberling has to come back, and I'm sure this is the substance of the whole discussion today, but I thought we'd just lead off with a basic question. Lines 3.19 through 3.24, as I read that, it says that a complaint that does not result in disciplinary action still has to be released, and if the complaint is pending, information about the allocation has to be released if there's a settlement. And I guess I'm just wondering, in your mind, how we balance our role as government employers versus our role as stewards of taxpayer dollars. And whether it's appropriate to have that kind of information released without some kind of final adjudication.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I'd be happy to try and answer that. I think it's an extremely important question. It's the linchpin of the issues before the committee on this bill. And it's an extraordinarily difficult question to answer in simple terms because, as someone once correctly said, it's not that the Data Practices Act is complex. It's that the subject matter the Data Practices Act addresses is complex. And you can't avoid that. And so what you find in the real world of government employment is thousands of different variations of complaints and investigations of complaints and discipline or proposed discipline. Now, I think it's fair, let me say it this way, I think it's unfair in many contexts that completely frivolous complaints made against government workers should be disclosed. I don't think that's a good balance. But I also think, I know from much experience, because I counsel reporters all the time all over the state about this, there are many very serious complaints that have gravity and merit made against high-ranking government employees that are swept under the rug by means of resignation and settlement agreements. In fact, you can make an argument based on experience that the more serious the complaint and the more legitimate it is, the greater the likelihood there will be a resignation and settlement agreement to keep it from being disclosed. And so somewhere in here there's got to be a balance where this, the complaints that are investigated and found to have real merit and are then the cause of a resignation agreement and buyout, that the public has some access to that. I mean, that was the original intent of this basic language 17 years ago, to do this. And it's failed at the municipal level. But I agree. We got to find a balance somewhere in here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Anderson, can you please describe for us why you believe this bill hits that balance correctly?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, it's a fairly simple answer. It's because for 17 years, the same language has worked quite effectively at the state level involving state executives. And I'm not aware of any evidence, actual evidence, that there's been a problem. So I extrapolate from that that it's unlikely we would have a problem if you extend this to just a few of the top level municipal employees. But I could be wrong. I mean, I am not the oracle.
Well, Mr.
You're the best we've got.
Well, I don't know about that, but.
Well, Mr. Anfinson and Representative Meyer, I note that as part of the amendment here that we're on right now, A3, you knock out basically the changes made on the top of page 2, which would have required some more specificity. I understand that was a sticking point. I'll tell you that I'm glad that you reach that accommodation, because it seems to me, and others think this doesn't go far enough, but my personal view is that, you know, asking for the specific reasons of the agreement, the nature of the acts, omissions, or other events, it's tough to get into that kind of detail. And I would just say, in terms of the language of the amendment, I think you were wise to dial that back a little bit. But am I reading that correctly?
My greatest concern is the problems that are in that subparagraph F. And so rather than be distracted with the issues on page 2, I decided that it would be better to take that out.
Members, any other questions as of now or comments? In terms of testimony. Okay, Mr. Aronson, there he is. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Roger Ernst, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, and we were caught up in this last year, and we're back here again today. I represent actually 1,700 people. They're the government employees. I know there's some discussion about highly compensated government executives. A lot of my assistant principals would beg to differ about that particular characterization. But a couple of things. This bill seeks to allow government to release what otherwise would be confidential data on my clients, my principals, to the public. I might say in the amendment, in the way it's fashioned, it goes far beyond settlement agreements because it puts us in a category that says, and if you go back on 2.27, this says upon the completion of an investigation or charge against a public official. So if there's any investigation that's done here, data of that investigation on school principals and assistant principals would now become public on this, whether there's a resignation agreement or not. might say you all know, being on this committee, that there are several aspects of data that are public as they relate to my clients. The existence of a complaint, the status of a complaint, if a complaint results in discipline that's final, the supporting documents of that discipline are public. If there's money paid in a settlement, that's public. And in addition, thinking of the accountability, and you get a lot of pretty significant examples in this, but my clients don't have any control if complaints are made to their licensing bureaus, the State Board of Administrators. If that data is final and becomes disciplinary, that's public. Behavior with regard towards students that's maltreatment, if that becomes true, that's public. So what aren't we releasing in this? It is very troubling for me that the fact basis that's being brought to you is what's referred to as the Sibley case, and the previous testifier, Mr. Gemberling, said, the lawyers in that should have consulted the Department of Administration before they did the settlement in that. I did the settlement in that. And school principals have a valuable commodity that districts are interested in resignations, and that's that they're treated as teachers. They have continuing contract rights. So when districts want to go a different direction from time to time, solely on there isn't a complaint there, settlement agreements are entered into. If someone had asked the West St. Paul District, was there a complaint against this individual, which I don't think anyone has, the district would tell them that the answer to that is no, that there isn't any data there to get on this. This isn't closing any loophole. The other piece that I want to emphasize with you, and by the way, the impetus for this bill in Burnsville was a $250,000 settlement with a business manager. It wasn't a school principal. I think school principals and assistant principals in Minnesota occupy a unique position, and I think the protections of their private data that exist in the statute are important and should be retained. But there was a weird connection to that as well that manifests itself in part of the language that Representative Meyer is seeking to delete, and that's that a settlement agreement was entered into that sought to release an ethics complaint against the superintendent as well. And there was some sense that that was really wrong. And I suspect that any cash paid to try to get an ethics complaint dropped is probably very wrong and against public policy. That's why that language is there. This was not done quickly in the Senate when this happened last year. This was major meetings of all of the involved players, a hard-fought compromise, multiple drafts exchanged with the Senate author to come up to this particular resolution. We don't think it has a loophole in it that you can drive a truck through, and we really think this bill should be defeated, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions or comments? Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one of the statements from Mr. Anfinson is that this has worked well for state employees, so why should local government employees be treated differently? And I wonder what your answer to that would be.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, and I can't speak really for other people other than my clients, the school principals, because I think that's a very fair inquiry. I do think that commissioners and assistant commissioners' positions are somewhat different than our school principals, and that there appears to be a decision to make a higher level of scrutiny that they have to disclose more to be in those positions. I do think, and I really, I don't know if it's worked well or not. Maybe there aren't as many complaints, but I can guarantee you that an awful lot of confidential data would be disclosed under this for my clients. So I can't really tell you why it's worked well on their behalf.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, I think the state employees who are covered by this have to fill out economic interest disclosure statements, do they not? Or maybe Mr. Gemberling.
I'd like to defer that question to Mr. Gemberling, if I can.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative Winkler. If you look on lines 2.33 through 3.1 and 2, what you'll see is that this the state language does not cover just commissioners and assistant commissioners. It covers executive or administrative heads of departments, bureaus, divisions, or institutions within state government. When I worked for state government, I was a division head, and therefore this language covered me. Okay? So in answer to your question, assistant or commissioners, deputy commissioners, and I believe assistant commissioners have to file economic impact statements. I was a deputy commissioner for a while, and I had to file one. Okay? So, but the other folks covered by the state provision don't have to file economic impact stuff.
So, Representative Whitaker. Mr. Chair, Mr. Gimberling, so what state officials are not covered by the economic interest disclosure but are covered by the data practices provisions we're discussing?
Gimberling.
The basic organizational structure of state government is you have a department headed by a commissioner. Within the department, you usually have bureaus headed by assistant commissioners. Somewhere in the middle of that, there's a deputy commissioner. Below that, you have divisions, and below that, you have units, basically. Now, that's not necessarily uniform. It once was uniform state government. It isn't anymore. So all of those positions down through division are covered by this provision, but not all of them are covered by the economic impact factor. Now, you also have boards and that kind of stuff. That's their reference back on page 2 on lines 34 and 35. All of those people are covered by this language, but I think they're covered by the economic interest thing because they're appointed by the governor through the open appointments process.
Representative.
No, thank you, Mr. Just an observation that one of the other bills that we're discussing this session is applying the economic interest disclosure statement requirements to county commissioners and judges, which haven't been done before. But a lot of other, even locally elected officials, just file those statements locally. And I don't think any of these local government employees would be anywhere close to having to file those. So I think I don't have an answer, but it seems like there is some kind of difference between most of the people at the state level who this language applies to and the kinds of officials we're talking about at the local government unit.
Okay, next on the testifier. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Scott.
Thank you. Mr. Gimberling, if I might, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. Would this provision also apply to MinSCU and U of M folks?
Gimberling.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, yeah, the MinSCU is a state agency, yes. And the U of M is specifically identified as a state agency in the Data Practices Act, and they lost a case in the Supreme Court a few years ago in which they argued they weren't subject to the Data Practices Act, but they lost that.
Thank you.
We'll go to the next testifier, and that is Keith Carlson. He's not here. Okay. Patrick Hines. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. Keith Carlson was unable to attend, but I'm testifying as a member of a group with the Minnesota Intercounty Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota School Board Association. And just to clarify some of the discussion on the amendment, the DE1 amendment was drafted by that group, and Representative Portman had generously offered to put it in front of the committee. It was drafted before the A3 amendment was drafted, and because they're similar, I think it would make most sense for me to talk to the A3 because much of what's in the A3 we agree with.
And Mr. Chair,
that's what I suspected. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, I drafted A3 after our conversation.
Okay. Mr. Hines.
Quickly, on lines 2.1 and 2.6 of the bill, that is, the new language is deleted, and the stricken language is reinserted. We support that change that Representative Myra has made. The language changes that appear on lines 3.9 through 3.16 of the bill. The DE1 amendment contains similar changes, and we support the language that Representative Myra has brought forward in the A3. I think this, at least the numeral 3, really addresses the Minneapolis situation, and I think there's general agreement that the person involved in the Minneapolis situation was intended to be covered by the legislation. It was sort of a weird structure for Minneapolis, so this would fix that. We're okay with the language on 313 through 317 as well. So what it really boils down to is the language you've been discussing on lines 3.19 through 3.24. And that language was put in there for an important reason, and I think Mr. Aronson mentioned it earlier. We're dealing with personnel data, which is presumed to be private data under the Data Practices Act. So this is data that is usually not public, and we're making an exception to it. And this language is important because we're concerned that, as Mr. Anfinson said, frivolous charges made against employees should not be made public. And these could be, you know, personality conflicts that devolve into accusations and charges that simply are not borne out and don't raise to the level of discipline. And we don't think that those type of charges should be made public. So we think that it is an important limitation, and it should remain in the bill. Having said that, we also understand that there are concerns that the bill that was passed last year isn't operating quite as it was intended. And so we recommended a change, which would be essentially to reinstate all of the stricken language on 319 through 324, with the exception of the last three words on lines 3.24, with another person. And what we feel this would do is that if you read the language in its entirety, then if there's a complaint or a charge that results in disciplinary action, the data relating to the complaint will be made public. If the employee resigns while the charge is pending, it will be made public. If they're terminated while the investigation is pending, it will be made public. Or if at any point they enter into a settlement agreement and they release potential legal claims as part of that settlement agreement, it will be made public. And the with another person language was put in there, I believe, because the bill last year was in response to the Burnsville School District situation, and that involved not only the employee who was eventually let go or resigned with, you know, pay out of the remainder of the contract, but it involved a third party. And as a result of that, that with another person language was added. If that's taken out, we feel that anytime there's a settlement agreement where you're releasing claims, that would be made public. And frankly, I can't imagine a situation where a city or a school district is going to pay out money remaining on a person's contract and not have a settlement agreement releasing potential claims against the entity. There's just not a situation where a city attorney or a school board attorney is going to allow that to happen. So our recommendation would be to reinsert the stricken language and except for with another person. We think that would more fully implement the intent of the law that was passed last session, but it would keep in place the important protections for employees.
Mr. Hines, thank you. I just want to, I think we've really, thanks to the Myra Amendment here, whittled down, narrowed down the areas of disagreement. So what we're really talking about, kind of the threshold issue as I see it starting on line 3.19, is do we or do we not want to preserve the separate but new newly separate, as of last year, status for certain local and school officials. So my understanding is that until last year's bill, it had been one standard. Last year's bill imposed for the first time this F language on 3.9, which separated out the standards, different treatment for certain local and school officials. And the question is, do we want to preserve that? It's new. It's only a year old, but do we want to preserve that or not? And then if so, then we'd get to under what circumstances. Am I understanding where we are?
Yes. Yes,
Representative Myra?
Yes.
Okay. So we've kind of narrowed the issue here. Members, comments, questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Myra.
The reason for taking this Section F out is I understand that there was a ruling on the City of Minneapolis case by the Department of Administration, and in conversation with them, this particular part of statute is what precluded them from releasing the data. I understand that there's members from the Department of Administration, and I was wondering if they would be willing to comment on what taking with another person out of this would do to this, and in light of those two situations that came up recently.
Actually, Representative Meyer, eventually, but I don't think right now.
Okay.
Only for two reasons. First, we have a couple member comments. Second, I know that Representative Norton has a testifier or two that might need to get going. So after we hear from comments from members here, I know it's a little unorthodox, I think we'll lay the bill over just for a few minutes so that those folks who have to leave. And then we'll resume this discussion. Representative Hortman, you can wait. Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question for Mr. Hines. As I recall, during the negotiations on this bill last year, you initially wanted this paragraph, which is now paragraph F, you initially were not okay with that being in there. And now you're okay with it being in there again. So I'm just a little confused on what made you change your mind.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I don't recall if at some point we opposed having that limiting language in there. I mean, it was part of a compromise that was developed over a series of meetings, mostly in the Senate, and I think we circulated A1 through A13 of various amendments until we reached this. So I don't remember, frankly, that I had said we were opposed to that. If I did, I apologize. But, you know, this was language that was agreed upon by a number of parties, including the House and Senate authors. And we do think it is an important protection. And if I could just add, to clarify one thing that Representative Simon said earlier, this language is new. However, the addition of the local government employees is also new. They were not part of this statute before. So there's never been a time where the local officials were covered without this language.
Okay, fair enough. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hines, with the limitations in the paragraph F and the this section in question, if you will, what happens to an employee that is terminated after investigation is complete?
Mr. Hines.
And there's no settlement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, if the investigation was completed and there was disciplinary action, then it would be public. If it was completed, there was no disciplinary action, and there is no settlement agreement, then I believe it would not be public.
Exactly.
But I would add that at that point, it would be highly unlikely that they would have received a payout from the entity. So they may very well have been an investigation and no disciplinary action, and if the person simply quit and didn't receive any payout, then I think that would remain private.
And Mr. Chair, that's part of the problem with this language, is that when the investigation's complete, the gig's up, they know they're caught, and they quit. That is all kept private, and they are able then to go apply for a job in another jurisdiction and do the same thing all over again. It's not all about a settlement. And it's not all about discipline sometimes. It's all about people that work for the public and have the public's trust and are paid for by public dollars, and whether or not the public has a right to know what's going on when they're doing bad stuff.
Representative Scott, I think you had a follow-up that I haven't seen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, your original proposal for your opinions on this bill, your original proposal did not include this language. So I'm just not seeing a consistency here and wondering what's going on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, again, I frankly am not sure what original proposal you're referring to. The compromise bill last year was worked on by many parties, and I don't know that the League of Minnesota Cities ever put forward a standalone proposal that didn't contain this language. Again, all I can say is that this was language that was worked out last session, and we believe it contains important protections. We supported the inclusion of this language in the bill last session. We realize that people are concerned that the language has not fully functioned as it was intended to, and we're recommending a change that we think will address those concerns. We understand concern with the West St. Paul School District issue, but we don't think that concern merits completely eliminating all of those protections that were passed as part of the compromise last year.
Representative Horton.
Well, Mr. Chair, is your plan to set this bill aside for a few minutes for us to do the Norton bill so people can get on the road?
Yes, it is. Members, we're going to lay over House File 604 just for a few minutes out of respect to Representative Norton, who has a time crunch. So with that, we'll lay the bill over temporarily, and we'll now take up. I will move that House File 782 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And would you like me to give my opening remarks and then have the person that has to leave? And then do we want to stop and come back to this later? I will be able to be here. It's just one of my presenters that cannot.
Whatever the time frame crunch is, let's accommodate that.
But. Okay. So, Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you extends the Newborn Screening Hearing Advisory Council until 2012, but of more important to this and interest to this committee, it addresses the retention of data for newborn hearing screening. In the 2012 legislative session, Statute 144.125, the statute that covers tests for infants for heritable and congenital disorders, was amended. It requires that all blood samples and test data with negative results be destroyed after 71 days and all test results be destroyed after 2 years. This will have a negative effect on newborn hearing screening efforts. The change suggested in this bill, exempting hearing screening data from that law, is our effort to keep Minnesota from becoming the only state in the country that destroys its newborn hearing screening data. Advocates and professionals believe that the integrity of the early hearing detection and intervention system is at risk. Children who are referred at birth to an audiologist for testing after their newborn screening and who were not diagnosed as deaf and hard of hearing have high risk factors, and that may eventually lead to a loss of hearing later in childhood. We fear that these children will not receive regular tests if the data is destroyed after 2 years. My special ed background and, frankly, master's work in the area of deaf education tell me that the amount of time a hearing loss goes undetected has significant and long-term impacts and effects on subsequent development. House File 785 would allow the hearing screening data to be saved until the child turns 18. Here to explain why this is important are Mary Hartnett of the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing, and a couple other testifiers, one of which has to leave, Dr. Lisa Schimenti. And so hers is the one we need to really get to first.
Doctor, Thank you. Just introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Dr. Lisa Scamenti. I am a pediatrician, and I care for children who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm also the chapter champion for the Minnesota Academy of Pediatrics, and my role is in educating pediatricians and caring for kids who are deaf or hard of hearing. First of all, thank you for allowing me to testify and bringing the time forward to allow me to be able to leave on time. So basically, newborn hearing screening is a practice where we identify children to be deaf or hard of hearing early in life. And the reason for doing this is that there have been a number of studies, many of them replicated, showing that children who are deaf or hard of hearing who are identified early and then habilitated will go on to have normal communication skills on par with their hearing peers and lower their lifetime costs for education and allow them to reach their full potential. By destroying data that's not genetic data, it's just hearing data from the newborn hearing screen, which is a bedside test where children basically just have headphones put on their head or an ear pod put in their ear to identify whether they may be at risk for being deaf or hard of hearing, impacts the whole process, whether a child passes that screen or refers on that screen. And what refer means is they did not pass the screen. I take care of kids who are deaf and hard of hearing, and what we find is that their diagnosis is frequently delayed. We have many children who have been through the newborn hearing screening process only to show up sometimes 2 years, 3 years, up to 6, 7 years later and be found to be deaf or hard of hearing and identified through other processes. So by gutting the data, we impact long-term follow-up and care for these children. The other issue is that we know that at least a quarter of the kids who pass newborn hearing screening by 9 months of age will be found to be deaf or hard of hearing. So we need to be able to go back and understand what happened during that newborn hearing screening process. Our processes are not perfect. We've only been in place in Minnesota since 2007. We're one of the last states to establish a mandated newborn hearing screening program. And by destroying data, we can't go back and make our process work. And so I urge all of you to give consideration to the kids who will be found later on to be deaf or hard of hearing, who by destroying their data will impact their medical care and ability to be habilitated and treated.
Thank you, Dr. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, and Dr. I think there's just some structural problems with the bill that we can work out, but the bill asks that you be exempt from the Genetic Privacy Act. What other, I mean, as I read your materials, it doesn't seem like you're actually doing anything that falls under that.
No, there is not. This is not genetic data.
Well, and so, if I might, why the exemption to that part of statute?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Representative Holbrook, I think given the judge's ruling last year, the language is such that it was quite broad, and there is a concern within the community that this is being interpreted because it says genetic material and test data, and this is considered test data. So we're afraid it's going to be swept in with that ruling, and I don't think it was intended to be. We're just trying to clarify that it is not.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, the newborn screening program was addressed and dealt with, so you're safer being part of the newborn screening program at this point than being out in the get out of jail free section part. So I don't, number one, I don't think you need that if you're not testing blood, et cetera. And then if I might clarify, you want to, for the babies that test positive, you want to have storage of the blood and the test results for more than 2 years, or what are you asking for
here?
There's
no blood in this process.
Right. Well, that's, Mr. Chair, that's kind of what I think we need some I need to understand what you're trying to do. And like one of the things in your statute, you reference the parents' rights under subdivision 3, but since the newborn screening statute was rewritten, the newborn rights of parents are laid out in about, I think it's 3 through 7 or something. So I'm thinking in order to get to where you want to be, you actually don't want to exempt yourself from the genetic privacy stuff. You want to stay under the umbrella of newborn screening. You want to make sure you reference the right portions of the parental.
We have an oral amendment that we have already prepared and handed them because it was the wrong citation. You are correct. It was wrongly cited. It should be subject to 144.125, subdivision 6 through 9, and we have that oral amendment.
I suggest then, because this may allay some of the fears here, Representative Norton, could you just state for the record again your oral amendment, which I understand that Mr. Gehring has already written down, but just state what it is for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 3.10, after the word health, strike, pursuant to this section, is not genetic information for purposes of section 13.386. Period, and insert is not subject to 144.125, subdivision 6 through 9.
Hold on for 1 second, Representative Norton. I think, Mr. Gehring, can you describe what you think might be a necessary modification to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I think you want to keep that pursuant to this section language just for clarity of the sentence. So so I'd suggest the amendment be page 3, line 10. Delete is not genetic information for purposes of section 13.386, and insert is not subject to section 144.125, subdivision 6 to 9. So then that whole sentence would read, data collected by or submitted to the Department of Health pursuant to this section is not subject to section 144.125, subdivision 6 to 9.
Is that Representative Norton? I just want to make sure then that's faithful to your intent here.
I believe it is.
Well, Mr. Okay. Chair, it doesn't fix it.
President Holbert.
I'm sorry. It doesn't fix it, and that's what I'm trying to get at, because they have a nuance of that they want to keep the test but not the blood.
There is no blood, Mr. Speaker, and I did want to clarify that. This is not about blood spots. It's simply the hearing test. But the Supreme Court ruling is some fear is being interpreted to mean that test data would have to be removed as well. So we're just trying to clarify that it does not. And the department looks like it's standing up, so perhaps.
All right, Representative Holbert.
No, they don't want to. He's just running out of the room at this time. I'm sorry, Mr.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we're giving them way more exception to the protocol and standards of newborn screening than what they're asking for by this language. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, okay, but I'm trying to make sure within the context of Chapter 13, and by the way, if this amendment were to go on, this would no longer really be a data practices bill because it wouldn't explicitly exempt them from any Chapter 13 provision, only Chapter 144, which is sort of a procedural issue for us to grapple with. But
Mr. Chair, that is the newborn screening, which has always come to the Data Practices Subcommittee along with the Medical Records Act.
Often, that's true, but I think there are some exceptions where it doesn't. But it is before us, and it will continue to be before us, and we'll probably just put it in the omnibus bill anyway, were this to pass. So, Representative Holberg, are you saying that I'm trying to figure out the basis for your conclusion that we're not solving the problem? Is it that we do need to mention Chapter 13 in here, or is it something else? Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you take out all those sections of what applies to this particular test under newborn screening, you lose all kinds of protections that the parent has relative to other areas of the screening beyond just that particular test. I'm probably not saying it very well, but...
Okay. Well, why don't we for now go... I think we have some other testifiers. Is Ms. Sivaraja here? Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Sivaraja, and I'm a member of the commission serving deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing Minnesotans. I'm also a member of the Newborn Hearing Advisory Committee and also here as the proud mother of a senior in high school who is deaf. I want to thank Representative Norton for introducing this important piece of legislation. When my son, who was our first child, was born, newborn hearing screening was not in place. From the time he was 3 months old, each time we took him in for his well baby checks, we told the pediatrician that we were concerned that maybe he wasn't hearing everything. At a 6 month check, the pediatrician clapped behind his head. My son turned and he said, "See, he can hear, he's just fine." Well, what I know now is that he actually felt the vibration. At 18 months of age, I expressed concern because he wasn't saying any words and didn't respond when I called his name at all. He wouldn't even turn. The pediatrician said, "Oh, that's just selective hearing." At that time, I needed a referral from the pediatrician in order to take my son to an audiologist. At age 2, I again expressed concern because he wasn't talking. The pediatrician told me that boys are slow, and her son never talked till he was 2.5 years old, and then he just started talking in sentences, so there was no need to worry. Thankfully, we had switched insurance companies, and I no longer needed a referral, so going to an audiologist was an option. When we took him to the audiologist, he was finally diagnosed as being deaf, profound hearing loss in both ears, at the age of 2 years and 4 months of age. Needless to say, he was a very frustrated little boy, having absolutely no ability to communicate, no language whatsoever. And we as parents were frankly pretty frazzled. What followed were years of auditory training, speech therapy, special education services, 4 years of attending a special school specifically for children with hearing loss before he was finally mainstreamed in third grade. It was a struggle to catch up, because he had never heard a sound until he was 3 years old when he received his cochlear implant. Having the newborn hearing screening system fully in place helps to ensure that other families and other children won't experience the great delays that we experienced in diagnosis of our son. As a member of the Newborn Hearing Advisory Committee, we've been discussing for about a year now the problems that data destruction will bring to newborn hearing screening in Minnesota. As Representative Norton mentioned, there's about 70,000 births in Minnesota each year. About 3,100 are referred for diagnosis, and of those, about 250 babies are diagnosed with having a hearing loss. A percentage of the babies that were referred but not to be found positive will find that later in life, within the first maybe 6 years, many of them have risk factors and may be found to have a hearing loss. Their hearing should be tested on a regular basis, and by destroying the results, it really loses the ability for us to encourage families to do that. If the early hearing detection intervention data is tied to the 2-year data retention policy under the newborn screening, there's also a potential loss for federal funds. The reason being is that the reports that are sent to the Centers for Disease Control are on data that's over 2 years old. So in 2013, the Minnesota Department of Health is reporting on data from 2010 and 2011. And so that data would already be destroyed by the time it comes time to report that to the CDC. No identifying data is reported to the CDC. It's really aggregate data. Now, back in 2007, when the hearing screening was added to the panel of tests administered at birth, we indicated that children would be better off if they received not only the screening and confirmation of hearing loss, but early intervention services as well. You know, in Minnesota, we recognize that newborn screening is expensive, but so is special education, to the tune of over $30 million for 2,600 children who have a hearing loss. You know, as a taxpayer, I think it's important that we can actually look at outcomes, what's working and what's not. We need to make sure that we have positive educational outcomes for children who are deaf and hard of hearing. And we are just 5 years into this, building the system, making adjustments to ensure that what we're doing will work. We've made great gains. In 2007, before the mandate, only 80% of hospitals administered the hearing test. Now 99.1% do. But not all parents follow up to get the diagnosis. In 2007, only 50% of parents followed up. to get a diagnosis. Now I'm happy to say that close to 93% of parents do. Early diagnosis and access to language makes a huge difference in the educational outcomes of children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Now I know one of the questions some of you may be wondering is, what's wrong with opting in after 2 years? There are differences in the opt-in frequency of different social and ethnic groups, and you can't address the concept of health disparities without having a population-based sample, or you end up having skewed data. The CDC will only track data that is population-based, and in Minnesota, we have a number of areas where we have health disparities within various groups for hearing screening. Those are the Hmong populations, Native Americans, Hispanic, and the African American communities. And so the Early Hearing and Detection Screening Advisory Committee is really working hard to make sure that we're designing strategies to really reach to those communities. And if you do opt in, you can't address the disparities, and the babies and children ultimately are the ones that are going to lose out. So I want to thank you for the opportunity, for allowing me to testify here today, and would appreciate your support of House File 782.
Thank you, Ms. Savaraja. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, do you believe parents should have the right to opt out of this storage and use?
Representative Norton.
I'm looking at some notes I have here, and I'm not certain with this change that we made, but I think we can, parents have opt in, and I think they can revoke that choice now in the current law. We're not changing that part of it.
Okay, Representative
Mr. Chair, Holbert. Again, I'm not talking about what your language says or doesn't say. Do you believe, as author of this bill, that you want to change the protocol on this particular test to storage beyond 2 years without consent? Do you believe parents should have the right to opt out of that? If they say, I do not want the health department tracking my kid, I can take care of this between my doctor and I.
Certainly, and I believe that we're not changing that or addressing that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think in talking to some of the advocates, it's probably not good to try and fix this on the fly. If we have a pretty clear understanding of what they want to accomplish, we can probably get language that can do that. But I am concerned the way that it's written, where they knock out four or five sections of newborn screening don't apply, you lose other protections that have nothing to do with the hearing test by doing that.
I do understand that issue. Two comments. First, I know we have one and maybe two more testifiers who want to be heard on this. Second, I do want to take a vote today, knowing there are other places that this can be fixed procedurally. I think we do have to move along. That's not to say there won't be other opportunities. There will be, to add language. But I don't want to lay this bill over. I want to take a vote on it. Right. Representative Norton?
And Mr. Chair, I'm certainly willing to work with Representative Holbrook, and I guess I'm kind of defensive because there's no intent to do what you're suggesting. So I'm willing to work with you on it. And we specifically didn't touch Subdivision 3, which I think addresses your concerns, just 6 through 9. So I'm willing to work with her. And support your effort to move this out.
We'll take you at your word, and yep. I hope you can confer offline. Any other testifiers on this bill? I know that Ms. Brace. Okay. I didn't see you. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I haven't until this morning actually gotten a chance to really look at this bill as small as it is. But sitting there, I have been able to come up with a few things that show why we're concerned, and concerned as Representative Holbrook is as well. So I just want to say a few things. That if you look at the overview in the House research, it very clearly talks about this written consent provision. And now that the amendment has the amendment actually been added, Mr. Chair? Amendment added? Sorry.
No, it's not.
Thank you. Okay, so the amendment's not been added. But let's just say if the amendment were added. So then I looked at sections 6 through 9, and Section 6 is the section where it talks about 71 days for the test results to be kept, or 24 months for the positive ones. Section 7 talks about parental options for storage and use. Section 8 talks about the extended storage and use of test results, and Section 9 talks about written informed consent for the use of samples and test results. So if it's exempt from those sections, then we feel that, unlike Representative Norton perhaps once, then it would be exempt from the consent and the opt-out requirements. We also, just because we think it's an interesting thing that the two bills are here today, but Representative Kahn's bill references this as well and says would take out the part that would give parents the notice of the right to opt out of the hearing and the data retention. The last thing that I'd like to say, and so we're concerned that we're really moving in the opposite direction and away from parent consent, but the other thing I'd like to say is that I took a look at the past research. And in 2006, they had a study, the health department had a study called Combined Genetic and CMV Screening to Improve Detection in Newborn Hearing Screening Programs. And they used 1,811 specimens, 1,811 control specimens. And so these were done without the parents' consent. It's a research project. And so we're concerned that by that exemption, we would continue to be able to use children's results and test results without consent, and that they would be stored long term rather than the 71 days or the 24 months that is currently in the newborn screening program.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. Go ahead. Just introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and Representative Norton, thank you. My name is Mary Hartnett. I am the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We are a non-cabinet state agency that advocates for and with people that are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing to develop public policy solutions to barriers faced in education, healthcare, employment, and access to public services. I'm very thankful to be here today, and thank you for taking the time to take Dr. Scametti's testimony, who actually was in charge of the research that had non-identifying data that was used, that Ms. Brace just referenced, that actually shows and demonstrates that about up to 40% of kids have that 40% of hearing loss is tied to CMV, to cytomegalovirus. So as a result of that test, we found one of the major causes of deafness, and that without using that blood and the that we had no identifying data in it, we never would have been able to have that study that now is being used across country and is saving lives. It actually can lead to, not only causes deafness, but also can lead to death. So it's an emerging test that probably will be added to the panel. So I just wanted to say that this test, this law has absolutely nothing to do with blood. It has everything to do with hearing screening, which is not genetic material. And we're thankful that you're willing to take a vote on it today, and we would love to see a yes in House File 782.
Representative Norton. Okay, anyone else who wishes to be heard? All right, we are going to take a vote today. So if there are no further comments, we have to vote on the amendment. I'm sorry. The Norton Oral Amendment as explained by Mr. Gehring. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Now we'll vote on the bill as a whole. I'll renew my motion that House File 782 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
We are now going to prevails. Thank you, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
We are now going to take up Representative Myra's bill again, which we had temporarily laid over. And I was told by one person that we may have
peace in the valley.
We may have peace in the valley. We may have some. Oh, are they still conferring?
No.
Oh, there's an amendment being drafted, I'm told. Okay. Well, Representative Myra, do you want to get us up to speed here? Get us up to date? Is there, do you think, some peace, a deal?
I think we are at peace in the valley. What I would like to do, if possible, is have an oral amendment to my A3 amendment.
Okay, let's do it.
And what that would be is to reinstate lines 3.19 through 3.24, or 3.23, reinstate line 3.24 through the word agreement, strike with another person, or leave that out, and have a period.
Mr. Chair, I think that's the amendment that Mr. Gehring already has.
Okay, I understand, Representative Myra, from Mr. Gehring, that when the written version comes, there are yet more changes that I think might effectuate what is the apparent agreement here. Can you, maybe as we're stalling a little bit, can you describe for us generally what, you don't have to go line by line, but
my understanding from talking to stakeholders on the issue is that my amendment A3 is acceptable to them, with the exception of they would like to have section or subsection F reinstated, and we have agreement that we would remove the three words at the end of line 3.24, which are the words with another person. So I don't know if it's possible that I could make that oral amendment to my A3 amendment.
You know, what I'd rather do, Representative Meyer, is wait for what I understand to be a written amendment, just so we're all clear, which I'm told probably most faithfully reflects the apparent agreement. Representative Winkler, do you have anything
to add? It's actually the amendment that I asked Mr. Gehring to draft, and Representative Meyer, I had the same conversation with some of the same folks before you did, and I would be prepared to vote for the bill if we adopted the A3 as well as that second written amendment, but there are just a couple of other things that have to be fixed in the language and the rest of the bill to make that change work. So we just want to make sure it's in writing before we adopt it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, you are correct because there are other references that were removed.
Okay. If that's the case, and if we're still waiting and if it's going to be a few minutes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I could just speak to what this actually does.
Sure.
And, you know, this is to the point of trying to balance out public information versus some reasonable respect for personnel privacy. If we adopt the as-yet unnamed A4, the A4 amendment, when it comes down, we are basically leaving the status quo, except that we are expanding the data that is public to include any data that relates to a claim based on conduct subject to a complaint where there is a settlement of any kind. The current law only permits a settlement agreement with a different person to be subject to data, public data, and this will actually apply to any settlement agreement. So it should capture most of the situations in which a legitimate claim has been filed, there's been some final determination, the person has quit, or it's been settled. And so it's sort of a middle ground spot.
And Representative Winkler, and the amendment doesn't touch the language we've already discussed, starting on line 3.10, in other words, fleshing out some of the other positions that would be subject to this.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't. In fact, this is premised on adopting the A3.
Okay. So first, why don't we wait for that to come, and while we're waiting for it to come, and unless there are other, Representative Scott, did you have a comment on this? Or?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that the League of Minnesota Cities is fine with this language, and everybody's okay with it.
And I have the same question. What I'd like to do, since it's probably going to be a few more minutes, I'd like to lay the bill over again because I want to be efficient and take up more bills because there are other members and there are testifiers here. So we'll lay over the bill yet again. It's not a problem. And we'll come back on the agenda and we'll go to is Representative Kahn here? Okay. Representative Kahn, why don't we go to your bill, the House File 589. I'll move then that House File 589 to be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Kahn, to your bill. Representative Kahn, after having invoked you, it's after having invoked you and your
right
recommendations about legislation, it's good to have
right
you back.
Well, this is another one of the bills that's here because of broadly interpreted court decision that needs to be somewhat restricted. And I guess I'd like to, instead of trying to explain it myself, I would like to move to the two people who are with me today to give an explanation of what we're doing in this bill.
Commissioner Koppel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. And just as a backdrop for this legislation to explain why it is before you today, in November of 2011, we had a ruling by the Supreme Court on the newborn screening program. Many of you are familiar. Last year then, with Representative Holbrook's help, we were able to address the issues needed to be addressed in the newborn screening program, and that bill was passed. But this is reflective of the Supreme Court decision in 2011 that said that the newborn screening program was not consistent, not operating under the genetic privacy statute. And that is because specific wording in the genetic privacy was interpreted very broadly to include all specimens and all biological information. So many things fall under that category. And so what we were very concerned about from that decision was genetic privacy impact on the programs that we operate at the Department of Health very broadly. We do a lot of collection, a lot of specimens. We store specimens. We certainly use these specimens when we're investigating disease outbreaks. It's an ongoing process. We asked and received, because of our concern for any exposure that we might have for additional lawsuits, we asked for a hold harmless till June 30th of this year. And that was part of the newborn screening legislation that passed in 2012. So what we were asked to do was to come back with what we thought would address the issue, a recommendation to address that issue, and that is the legislation that is before you today. What this legislation does is respond to what the Supreme Court used in a ruling. It said, unless you have express authority to store, use, collect, or disseminate data, which we didn't have in newborn screening for all of those things, then you need consent. We have many, many programs that we operate, especially around disease outbreaks, but other collections of ongoing population-based data that does not get consent and is not express authority. It's general authority. It may have been done through rulemaking, but it is not express authority. What this bill does is basically show the various activities that go on in the health department and puts those activities in statute, makes them express so that they are not subject to be interpreted by any court as not following the genetic privacy statute.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Oren, do you have anything to add? Okay. Members, Representative Holberg, I noticed that you are a co-author on this bill, so I assume I assume you're in support.
Mr. Chair, I still have some concerns. We're working out. We're still talking.
Okay.
By the time it gets to the floor, I'll either still be a co-author or I'll remove my name. Okay. So.
Members, any other comments? Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically what this bill is doing then is it's retroactive for all the data that you've collected. And what you're saying is you're protected from all that, you know, from anyone from the past that's had their data collected. You're saying that you're safe from lawsuit. That's what this bill does?
Mr. Koppel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. To the extent that under the programs that we operate that we have collected data as done under either under general authority or rulemaking, yes.
Wow.
Representative Scott. Okay. Anyone else? I'm sorry. Any other member comments, questions, concerns? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay. Seeing no one. I'm sorry. Ms. Brace.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Bray.
I don't know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Brays. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And this bill proposes to limit and eliminate many of the genetic privacy rights of individuals. There are many troubling concerns, but first, I have a different version of why we're here. So in 2003, our organization unexpectedly discovered the warehousing of baby DNA, the storage, use, and dissemination of baby DNA was being done without legislative authority. It took 6 years to get a lawsuit and nearly 3 years for nine families to win that lawsuit in the Minnesota Supreme Court. Last year, the department claimed that the court's ruling threatened them with more lawsuits for all the other biological specimens that they have obtained without legislative authority or legislative knowledge. In conversations with the department and Representative Holberg, the department promised to spend last year coming up with a report of all the biological specimens they have in exchange for freedom from lawsuits for a year. They got that freedom, but the department has not provided the list, the report, because they say the law didn't specifically require them to do so. They tell me that they have done their own analysis of everything they have, but that they are not required to produce it because last year's bill didn't require it. Well, we consider this very troubling, not only because they are in violation of the agreement, but also because we have no idea what they are storing, using, or sharing, and have been doing so for decades without legislative authority or knowledge. Nor does the public know. We only happened to find out about the baby DNA. Had we not, they could have continued to store, share, and use it without or for research in far into the future, and none of us would have been the wiser, as they violated the genetic privacy rights of all these newborn citizens and their parents. This bill will protect them from lawsuits for all the other unauthorized collection, storage, and use activities. Now, they claim they are doing these activities under the general authority of the department, but if that's true, why do you pass laws that give them specific authority if their general authority is legal authority to do it anyway? They have been acting for years as if they didn't need your permission for whatever they want to do with our genetic information and personal health records. Only because they've been found out and successfully sued do they now want to be sure they can never be sued again for whatever DNA and health data they have already collected, stored, used, and shared, and for whatever they plan to collect, store, use, and share for analysis, research, and all sorts of other purposes into the future. This is a very broad-reaching bill. This bill essentially gives the department ownership of all this data, and unless I'm missing something, nothing prevents them from transferring or selling that ownership to others, all without the individual's consent or knowledge. Furthermore, we have no idea how many databases or registries they have that are not specified in state law. The newborn screening database was keeping genetic test results since 1986 without any statutory authority. The only authority in law was for a registry of positive test results. The lawsuit forced them to get consent. So to this bill, there are a few things I just would like you to notice. The definition of health data on line 2.10, which is not actually detailed in the bill, is broad. It's from Chapter 13, and it says that health data are data on individuals created, collected, received, or maintained by the Department of Health, political subdivisions, or statewide systems relating to the identification, description, prevention, and control of disease, or as part of an epidemiological investigation the commissioner designates as necessary to analyze, describe, or protect the public health. A very broad definition, and that's the definition that is included in this bill. So this would appear to include all electronic medical records in the state health information exchange, as well as the all-payer claims database. Use and sharing of health data is authorized in lines 2.21, line 3.16, 3.27, 4.6, 4.10, and 4.23. Line 3.25 adds a new definition of biological specimens and health data to the definition of genetic information outside the Minnesota Genetic Privacy Act. So it is a new part of the statute saying that it's genetic information one place versus genetic information another place. We don't know the full effect, but we do know it could be used to potentially neuter the Genetic Privacy Act, especially in the court of law. There are also many undefined broad terms, such as on line 3.1, where biological specimens and health data can be used to monitor the health status of a population, and 3.8, where it can be used for conducting other activities necessary to protect or improve the health of individuals and populations. Well, this is very broad. Who decides what are other activities or when this is necessary? On line 3.12, the bill limits the definition of research exempting all research taking place under the department's program operations from the definition. On line 4.9, health data is stored potentially forever as government data. Furthermore, biological specimens have no limit on state retention. On lines 4.5 to 4.6, the commissioner can use the specimens and medical records without consent for federally approved research, which allows researchers to use specimens that have the individual's identities linked with the code. Keep in mind that all DNA is identifiable. On line 4.33, the change leaves out the parents' rights to be told they can opt out of the newborn hearing screening and the storage of the results, in connection, of course, with the bill that we just heard. So we look at this bill and say it's an amazing violation of privacy rights in violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's an unprecedented data grab by the government of the most private data on individuals. It's also a power grab by the government because, as I like to say, he who holds the data makes the rules. If you pass this bill, you will first of all have no idea what you are authorizing because the department has not revealed all the data and genetic information they have already collected and are collecting without your authority, all the situations under which it's doing this collecting, or how it has been shared or used in the past. Thus, we oppose House File 589 and think it should be defeated. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Price.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's this testimony would strike to the heart of everything the Department of Health does to protect the public. One of the things that, and the reason this bill is necessary is that the department was operating under the general authority which they thought it had. Because of a misconstructed Supreme Court decision, a very broad definition was given to what genetic information was, to include specimens of all kinds. Anyone wants to read some very literate and exceptionally intelligent commentary on this, I recommend the dissent by Justice Paul Anderson to that decision. But the one thing that decision said was that the department could only do things for which it had express authority for, which required the newborn screening bill to be written last year, because that was going to that decision put us in conflict with federal requirements for accreditation of the whole department. What this does is then follow up for other specimens which are doing with the concept that a specimen, particularly a de-identified specimen, which many of these are not data. For a more technical thing, I guess I would refer to the Department of Health. But all this is, it is not new authority, and we specifically, because of all the effort that went into the newborn health screening last year, specifically didn't want to let any confusion that this was interrupting that process. So that's why that exemption from that is in there. And I'd rather have anything that you need that's more informative or more technical, I'd rather have my friends from the Department of Health back to do it.
I hope we don't unravel the fragile Holberg-Kahn consensus here too quickly. With that, Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Representative Kahn, our concern, of course, is that the collection, storage, use, and research on baby DNA was being done under the general authority. And if the general authority, that is how it was being done because there was no express authority to do so. So all those years that was being done, and only because we discovered it are we in this situation now, because a court of law, the Supreme Court, found that that was not the right thing to do because there was no express authority. And as a matter of fact, it was in violation of the Genetic Privacy Act. So that's our concern, that all of this would just continue under general authority.
Well, and I understand that we can revisit the Supreme Court case for a very long time.
Well,
one quick comment, Representative Conner, I want to go to Representative.
As the author of the Genetic Privacy Act, which started all this out, it was never intended to have the broad sweep that the Supreme Court gave it.
Representative Whitmer.
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe I'll be the anti-Braze here so that Kahn and Holberg can stay together, which is Representative Kahn, if you wanted to author legislation to reverse the Supreme Court decision in its entirety and give the Department of Health that general authority, I'd be strongly in favor of that.
Well,
I think the baby's lives are more important than their privacy, but that's just my point of view.
Actually, I do have a connection with a Supreme Court justice whom I usually run with every weekend, and I have persistently told him that it was a stupid decision because he was on the wrong side of it, and he has specifically said we're welcome to do any change we want as long as it's constitutional, and I think that this is following his advice.
Any other member comments, questions, concerns? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? All right, then I'll renew my motion that House File 589 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kahn. We will now, I believe we have the amendment for Representative Myra's bill, the compromise amendment. So let's take up Representative Myra's bill yet again, House File 604, which we had laid over. Do all members have a copy of the proposed amendment?
Okay. He's bringing it around.
Griffin?
No, he's bringing it.
It's being handed out right now.
Mr. Chair, has the A3 been adopted?
No, it has not been adopted.
And so those two amendments are intended to be consistent, so we could take action.
So we should. So this is written to the...
It doesn't matter. We could do either one. They're not dependent on each other, but
the A4
is intended to go on after the A3.
Mr. Gehring, is the A4 adopted, assuming adoption of the A3, or no? Independent. Well, then, I'd prefer, then, if you could withdraw the A3 amendment, why don't we just take up A4?
I withdraw the A3 amendment.
Okay. And then I'll move the A4.
We do need both.
Do we need, well, we
yes.
need both?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. So I'll remove A3. Okay. We're on A3. Why don't we just adopt the A3 amendment and then discuss and see whether we want to adopt A4. All in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, we are now on the A4 amendment. I will move the A4 amendment. Representative Myra, can you describe the amendment?
Thank you. I appreciate your patience, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment reinstates language on line 227. That references paragraph F. It also reinstates paragraph F, line 319 through 323. And on line 324, it reinstates the stricken language, complaint or charge are released as part of a settlement agreement.
Okay.
And it reinstates the period as well. It also, on line 3.25, reinstates the stricken language and deletes the does.
Okay.
And I'm fine with this amendment.
All right. Members, questions, comments, concerns from members of the committee? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this amendment? Okay. This is the A4 amendment. We'll then vote on the A4 amendment. All in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
No.
Aye. Opposed, no. The amendment the motion prevails. I think we're ready to discuss House File 604 as amended. Representative Myra, closing thoughts.
I would really appreciate your support. I know taxpayers and parents alike want more information when large sums of money are paid out as part of a settlement agreement. There seems to be a lot of agreement among stakeholders that these changes that we have adopted today will take care of some of the loopholes that have been identified in the last 9 months of the statute being in place. I'd really appreciate your support. I understand that Mr. Gimberling would also like to make a comment.
Briefly,
if that's
Mr.
all right.
Mr. Chairman, Don Gimberling again. The peril of having those of us who are data nerds sit around here too long is you start seeing things. The last section of this bill, the effective date, line 3.27, 3.28, says the act is a section of effective following final enactment applies to data on investigations that are completed on or after the date of the effective date. My recollection is that when the The original settlement language was placed in the Data Practices Act. That placement produced Minnesota Statute Section 1303 sub 9, which says that data is classified as of the time somebody asks for it, notwithstanding any other previous classification. So I look at the last two lines of Representative Myra's bill. I look at 1303 sub 9, and I just want you all to understand what I think is your choice. The current law says data is classified as of the time you ask for it. If you enact this provision, you're saying that these kind of data, settlements made in the past, etc., won't be available to the public. Now, you clearly have the right to do that if you want to do it, but you'll have a general rule, and then this will be an exception to that general rule. And you will, frankly, add to the ongoing criticism that the Data Practices Act is too cumbersome and too complicated, okay, and that it's not consistent. The other body last night, I swear, I didn't keep exact count, but they used the word consistent or inconsistent somewhere around 100 times, so, because of these kinds of discussions. So all I'm really doing here is making sure you're understanding what you're doing. That's all. So,
thank you, Mr. Gamberling. Any other member comments, questions? Representative Horton.
Not to the point Mr. Gamberling raised, but just to the general issue of the bill. I fall out a little bit differently than others on this topic. I'm in favor of settling disputes and resolving things as cheaply as possible. I used to do employment discrimination. I've done both defendant side, plaintiff side. I've done investigations. And there often isn't a truth. It's in the eye of the beholder. But there's accusations made that can really damage people's careers. And so, to the extent that the Myra bill last year, I think, made it harder to settle disputes, I don't like going in that direction. I understand that the deal makes things better from what was adopted last year and solves some problems. But I just think the counterpoint needs to be brought out, too, where, not all these cases, I think, should be litigated to the very end. And I think that sometimes if things have to be made public, it will increase litigation and draw out disputes rather than wrapping things up sooner. And it's not as clean as we would like. I think there's a public interest when public money is spent that we know why it's spent. But we have to balance that with trusting people who are elected to public office and have power of the purse in those situations to do what's in the best interest of taxpayers at the cheapest possible price. And I think we tie their hands a little when we tell them what has to be public and what doesn't have to be public. So I just want to articulate the counterpoint to the Myra point of view.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
may
Myra.
I comment? Thank you. One of the things about line 319, it is data relating to a complaint or charge. So it isn't just a situation where parties want to, separate ways, but it is when there is a complaint or a charge. Thank you.
Okay. Members, I think we're ready to vote, unless there's a last comment. Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, would this then affect Mr. Gamberling, the effective date only affect data under the new provisions enacted, or are we, by putting this effective date, changing the protocol for all data on state employees, officials, and everybody prior to the enactment of this law? How would that be sorted out?
Mr. Chairman, I think you should hear from your counsel, but I think because it says this section. It means this section of the bill, not this section of Minnesota statutes. So you'd be left with old settlements in state agencies being public, but old settlements in political subdivisions being not public. Okay? That's why I wanted you to understand that. So one of the most awful questions I ever fielded at the department was a call from an attorney for a professor at the university, who had agreed to a settlement agreement based on some charges that he felt were frivolous. But his attorney advised him, look, just settle this. I can't remember some low level of discipline, whatever. But because of the 1303 sub 9 language, the university interpreted those settlements to be public information. And my unfortunate task was to tell the attorney the university is right. So,
Representative Hallberg?
I don't know if Mr. Gehring's going to weigh in on my question.
Mr. Gehring, can you weigh in on the scope of the effective date?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, it's correct that the effective date in the section applies to the changes that are being made in the bill, so it's not changing the full section of statute. It's just providing that what's being amended here in the bill will apply going forward to new settlements. So there will be settlements under the existing law that will continue to have the classification provided under the existing law and won't be affected by how this bill is being changed.
And so if I might, for clarification then,
Representative Hallberg,
if it was a complaint or dispute that was started under, let's just say there's a one-year time from the first MIRA bill, the second MIRA bill, and then how does this effective date act on those?
Mr. Carey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, the changes that are in the bill will apply if there's a settlement or a completed investigation that occurs after this bill is enacted. So it doesn't matter what time the investigation started. It depends on what time the investigation is complete.
Okay, and would this effective date shield or turn off access to any settlements or disputes that have an effective date in the last year prior to this new enactment?
Mr. Gary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, the changes that are in this bill won't affect settlements that were completed or investigations that were completed within the last year. Those settlements will be subject to the existing law.
Ms. Beyer-Kropinski, you have something to say about that? Just introduce yourself to the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Lori Beyer-Kropinski, Director of Community Services for the Department of Administration. I wanted to add a little bit more information to what Mr. Gemberling and Mr. Gehring. The standard that is laid out in 1303 subdivision 9 says unless otherwise expressly provided by a particular statute, the classification of data is at the time that the data request is made. Given where you have placed this effective date, I don't think it would meet the standard of expressly provided by statute, because the effective date will not become statutory language. So if you want to treat settlements that occur at a certain time frame, that language would need to be in the body of the statutory provisions that you're passing, if that makes sense.
Yes,
a similar example would be what we did last year around prevailing wage and information about subcontractors, where we had the language about when a contractual relationship would occur was in the body of the statute and laid out a certain date. So we had people who were treated differently depending on when a contract was entered into. It is possible to draft that. It's just not it's not how it's been drafted here.
Okay.
So that would be a policy decision for you to weigh.
Members, any comment on that? Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, it seems like if nothing else, we should at least strike that language from the effective date, because it just by putting it in, I suppose, session law, it's just going to create confusion. So I would move to strike on line 3.27 the final word and then strike line 3.28 and insert a period after enactment.
Okay. Does everyone understand the amendment? Mr. Gehring?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so the proposed amendment is page 3, line 27, delete and then page 3, line 28, delete everything before the period.
Okay. All in favor of the Winkler oral amendment, as just described by Mr. Gehring, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. I think we are now back on the main bill. I think we're ready to vote. Unless there's anyone else who really needs to weigh in on this issue, we're ready to vote on the final bill as amended. So I will renew my motion that House File 604 be recommended passed and re-referred to this Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have two bills left, one of which is the vehicle bill. And so by process of elimination, that leaves Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, we're going to continue the practice where members present their bills from the table.
Sure.
Mr. Shetnan is coming down from Metropolitan Council. This is a bill that I'm carrying for Metropolitan Council.
Right, you want to move the bill?
And I would move that House File 584 be recommended passed and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Right, thank you. Mr. Shetnan, welcome. Introduce yourself, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Not very often the Council finds itself in front of the Data Practice Subcommittee, so thank you for giving us the opportunity. What we have here before you today is a bill that our Metro Transit fare revenue collection staff have brought to the Council and asked us to proceed based on trying to classify some information related to our transit rider data. And Mr. Chair and Representative Portman, we do, as part of our bill here, have an amendment, hopefully an author's amendment, that that we worked with Ms. Beyer-Kapinski and also Ms. Christensen over at the Department of Administration to clean out some language in our bill that we were told is redundant. So for the case of trying to make sure we've got a clean bill, we do have that author's amendment. But
Mr. Chair, right now, why don't we just go ahead and take care of that? I'll move the A1 amendment.
Okay. A1 amendment is before us. Mr. Shetnan, you want to explain it? Or
Mr. Chair, members, again, all it is basically redundant language that the department is saying is unnecessary, and it would just be confusing to add it.
Okay. Members, any comments, questions, concern about the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbrook.
Redundant to what, someplace else in the bill?
Yep.
Or
Mr. Shetnan.
It's Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook. The department says it is just redundant in statute.
Representative Holbrook?
Well, I'm just...
That's satisfied.
I don't see where it is somewhere else in the bill, and I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, I know that Ms. Beyer-Kapinski or Ms. Christensen from the department can speak to that if you'd like.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Stacey Christensen, Administrator of the Information Policy Analysis Division within Department of Administration, and the language is redundant in other places in Chapter 13. So there was, for example, a traveling data provision that is always already allowed for in other places in Chapter 13.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Shannon?
Mr. Chair and members, we have a brief presentation Mr. Thomas here from the from Metro Transit that we can walk through. I don't know, for the sake of time, if you want us just to speak to the bill or if you want us to go through
the
presentation.
I think it would be helpful just to speak to the bill for now. If members have questions, any more information, we can go through the fuller presentation.
Great. Well, with that, I am just going to ask Mr. Thomas here to briefly explain why Metro Transit is pursuing this, and then I think we'll be...
Before we do that, we need to adopt the amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay. We're on the bill as amended. Mr.
Hello,
Thomas.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Tom Randall. I'm Senior Manager of Revenue Operations for Metro Transit. We service the entire Metropolitan... We service as the agency of Metropolitan Council, the entire fare collection system for our fixed route and other services as well. We bring forth this item to classify individual data gathered via the regional fare collection system and the personalized web services that we've developed as private to match customer expectations and peer agency practices. The regional fare collection system consists of fare boxes on buses, as well as more recently our go-to card system, which is an electronic fare collection system. I'll just speak briefly to that. The electronic fare system, it contains a computer chip, much like an access pass you may be familiar with. In less than half a second, it offers a secure way for a patron to pay their fare on the bus or rail vehicles as well. With that process, sometimes a patron can choose to provide us information to manage that account and use other services that we provide on our website now, and we desire to have that information be considered private, that they provide us for those purposes. This is in line with other peer agencies. We've developed our item based on analysis of Boston, the MBTA, the Seattle region, where they use the ORCA card, similar smart card programs, as well as Atlanta.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Randall.
As brief as I can. Yeah.
Members, any comments, questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious what you do with all this information that you're gathering. I mean, and it also, this bill is also allowing you to share the information with other government entities, and I wondered why you'd need to do that.
Mr. Randall.
Mr. Chair, representatives, with this information that's gathered on a wide basis, we are able to develop more efficient service planning for the bus routes and the light rail timings, as well as develop very much more precise fare collection prices for our fare products, actually providing more value for the minimum amount of dollars that we are required to charge to maintain our operational fee and a representative. We use this in aggregate. We don't generally use the detailed personal data unless a customer would call and request, say, a refund on their card. Then they've provided personal identification so we can ensure that card was registered to that, and we can refund the value to them as well. Sometimes we might share with other government agencies if we were on a wide scale developing a master route plan or something like that. It's on an aggregate basis rather than on an individual basis is generally how that works.
President Scott. Okay. Members, any other? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, lines 9 through 12, that's really broad authority and no statement of purpose or anything. I think you should look at for particular purposes or, I mean, to the extent that it's summary data, it's one thing, but if it's individual data, I mean, you just put it all there in that line. You can give it to anybody for, you don't identify any limitation for purposes. I mean, that is really, really broad language, so I think that should be cleaned up. And on page 2, lines 17 and 18, is there a reason why you would be giving this data to the transit police or other law enforcement agencies outside of their broad authority to data for investigative purposes?
Mr. Shannon?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll speak to the first, Representative Holbrook's first point, and I'll let Mr. Randall speak to the second point. But I can appreciate what you're saying, that this is a relatively broad authority, and as I mentioned before, we are interested in trying to protect this data. However, if the committee believes that this is too wide, I'm certainly open to hearing from the members if we should tighten that up, because Representative Holbrook, I can tell you we're not trying to, as referenced earlier, drive a truck through something. We want to leave in a hole wide enough to drive a truck through it.
Mr. Chair, I mean, you could interpret this that an organization could be the Retailers Association, and they want a list of all your people to send them great coupons for discounts on coffee shops near transit center. I mean,
And Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, Mr. Randall can speak to this, I think, to get to your point.
Mr. Randall?
Mr. Chair, representatives, that provision, we have many members that subsidize the fare cards for their customers, and that provision is intended to only apply to those government agencies, organizations, or school districts that do subsidize, maybe provide their cards for free to those participants in the program. So we get requests sometimes that people want to use their dollars as best they can. So if an organization is providing, say, free transit passes, they want to understand that those transit passes are being used, or they'll reallocate the dollars elsewhere. So that's only intended to apply to the existing customers who subsidize fares for individuals.
And again, we're not going to fix this here today, but The other thing is in the 17 and 18, there's broad authority for law enforcement agencies to get access to data for investigative purposes. So when I read this, this tells me you're going to be given information to cops for non-investigative purposes, and I don't know why you would need to do that.
Although, Representative Holberg, that there is language that says only as they're conducting investigations on the end of line 2.17 and 2.18.
No.
You're saying they
and other agencies conducting investigations. It doesn't say a purpose. It just has to say they're an agency that conducts investigations.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
I don't think you need that language unless for some reason you're giving them information outside of criminal investigations. Mr. And if you are, I'd like to know why.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I appreciate that point as well. Speaking with our legal counsel, they're saying the reason why Metro Transit Police would use this information is for the purposes of making sure people have paid their fares. So when they're using the card, we'd be able to check if they say that they are actually using their card when they actually don't.
I understand that point. Back to the other point, though, it might be cured. I'm thinking on line 2.17, after the word agencies, you might put the words in the course of conducting investigations, meaning it's not just agencies who do conduct them, but in the course of.
And, Mr. Chair, maybe...
Hold on, Representative Holberg, you first, then Representative
you're trying
Holberg.
To get rid of me, but I think I've said when the statute books get to 16 books instead of 15, I'm out of here. It's stupid. I'm sorry. I shouldn't use that. It doesn't make sense to put redundant language. I mean, if law enforcement has broad powers for investigative purposes, they can pretty much get access to any information they want in this state. We don't need to put it in there.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Holberg and I will work on this rather than try to do it on the fly here and take the whole committee's time. By the time we get back to civil law, we'll have language that tightens this up because I agree with her on both counts.
Okay. That's certainly good enough for me. Members, any other questions, comments, concerns? Anyone wishes to be heard on this bill? Sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hughes, and I hope this pertains to the bill, but I am a Metro Mobility rider, and we have data practice there, too, that it does adhere to and belong to the Met Council. I've had troubles before where I've requested information, gotten somebody else's private information on incident reports, and we've had troubles with computers going down and not having enough backups to be able to make rides because they don't have the right plan to be on a computer system. So I think you have a bigger problem that's adhered to for customer data, and I don't think this data is as protected as you might think it is. So I think we have a whole bunch of facets here that have to be looked into. So I just want that to be duly noted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Any other testifiers on this bill? Ms. Fraser.
Right.
I'm a bit surprised to see you here, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We'd like
to add some election
somewhere.
Bills. No, just kidding. Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. And I am here because we run the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program, and the participants of that program are primarily survivors of domestic violence, although it does include some who are in the program for professional reasons such as prosecutors or law enforcement. And we are very supportive of this bill. We did not realize that this data was available or was public, so we're very supportive of making it private. That's a great step in the right direction. But as we've looked at the language, we have been in conversation with Metro Transit about ways it could be tightened up and concerns we do still have with the broad authority to share the data. We've had some conversations about exactly what data is shared, and it sounds like they typically don't share all the data that it sounds like this would give them the authority to share. So there may be ways to specify exactly what can be shared. Perhaps there could be an exemption for Safe at Home. So I just wanted to say, generally, we're very supportive of the bill. We do think it could be tightened up, and look forward to working with Representatives Portman and Holberg on finding some language to make it tighter. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. I just noticed here that Representative Holberg, you're on the bill. That Mr. doesn't Chair, bind you to anything, but, hopefully it means you're invested enough in the outcome to work with folks.
I can't even tell you how many times in the last 2 weeks people have put data bills under my nose and, will you help me? And maybe that's one of the symptoms of my frustration today.
Members, I think we're ready to vote. Unless there's anyone else who needs to testify in this bill. Representative Hortman renews her motion that House File 584 be recommended to pass and as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman. That's one more bill plus a bunch of amendments. This will be the vehicle, the omnibus vehicle, I suppose, even though I want to sort of sit up here. It's probably not appropriate for me to chair. So, Representative Hortman, just because you're sitting closest, do you mind chairing?
I don't mind.
You can stay there if you want. So,
you know, if I was door knocking, we don't really need that. Knuckles looks
real. Madam Chair, I will move my bill, which is, let's see it. Oh, here it is. 695. I'll move the House File 695 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law.
Representative Simon, do you have a testifier that you'd like to introduce?
I do, Madam Chair. He can introduce himself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Ranum. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota Library Association. Our goal here with this bill is to extend the current protections for content and transaction services that libraries currently provide across to new electronic content that libraries don't own but lease through vendor and vendor services, as well as other kinds of electronic services that we lease or purchase from vendors. This just protects the privacy of patrons from random or unauthorized access from law enforcement or other officials.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And why don't you believe you have this authority already by virtue of the contract that you have with them?
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, we don't believe that the current law covers vendors that we contract with based on other states' interpretations of their data privacy laws and changes that they've made. California just established a whole new set of data privacy laws that covers not just libraries, but everything, including bookstores and other other people who work with content materials. The contracts with the vendors don't specifically talk about the transaction data and their responsibilities when they get inquiries from law enforcement without court orders or subpoenas or other legal documentation.
Representative Holberg.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So, but don't your libraries have to contract with these vendors? And can't, as a component of that contract, you have the vendors adhere to Chapter 13?
Could you repeat your name?
Sure. Mark Ranum.
Ranum. Mr. Ranum.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, that potentially could be part of the contract. However, these vendors typically, and by the way, the vendors have not raised any objections in for us to include this in Minnesota law, but the vendors generally don't have those kind of privacy statements, and when we try to negotiate off of anything new into their boilerplate, they're usually objecting to that particular process. And we think that this is a way for us to cover not just, I mean, we're talking about, you know, dozens and dozens of vendors for most libraries that we're dealing with, and so this would cover us in sort of a blanket fashion.
Representative Holberg. Other questions for the testifier or for Representative Simon? Representative Simon renews his motion that House File.
Actually, Madam Chair, since this is the vehicle bill for the data practices omnibus, we'll have several amendments that encompass the bill, the bills that we've just been dealing with. So I don't think we're ready to vote on the overall bill yet.
So you want to hang on to this one in the subcommittee?
Well, no, we're going to put a bunch of amendments on.
Right now.
I hope, right now, and then move it out. I think that's the idea.
Okay.
So,
Representative Simon. I like to park my vehicles on the general register and load them up later, but if you want to load it up right now, let's.
Madam Chair, we're going to load them up right now, but may I, just as an interlude here, make a motion. I'm going to move approval Before I move approval, I want to talk about the minutes. We need to amend the minutes, if you have them before you, of the February 27th. So I would move...
It was a big win when somebody's read the minutes.
That's, forget that. We'll do the minutes after we're done with this bill.
Okay.
I can't do it. Only one item of business at a time. So, Madam Chair,
Representative Simon, would you like to move an amendment to your bill?
Yes. Mr. Gehring, do we have... Can you just describe briefly what... Are the amendments being... Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Holberg,
can I ask one more question? Would this language in your bill shield any components of the contract about the vendor?
We'll wait till he's done with this conversation before we recognize him. Mr. Random, there's another question on the language in the bill. Representative Holberg, if you could repeat your question for Mr. Random.
Well, I'm always looking at unintended consequences here, and it's looking like we are going to say that the vendors are going to have private data on individuals and can't be disclosed except for library purposes or pursuant to a court order. So will I be able to find out the names of the people in the vendor contract that executed the contract or are responsible for the deliverables or...
Mr. Annam.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, if I understand your question about this topic, the private data is either is the transactional data that links the names of individuals with either subjects requested or searched for or materials and content that they have accessed through these vendor services. All of the other information on the contract about the contract itself would be public information, except where, you know, vendors keep certain contract information private and have assigned non-disclosure agreements for certain types of, you know, business-related practices. But from the point of view of users, I believe that all of that is private.
Mr. Chair, I'm just asking about... Madam Chair, I'm sorry, on individuals, because you say our private data on individuals. So I'm guessing those components of the contract will be public, but...
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Holberg, I think the way this is constructed is that subdivisions 1 and 2 on lines 1.11 through 1.14 are the only things that are private. So it's only data that links a patron's name with materials requested or borrowed, and it's only data in applications for borrower cards. So 1 and 2 are the only things that are private, and I think what the amendment or the bill does is just say that whether that data comes from the library or from a vendor, if it is linking the patron's name with the materials, it's private.
Mr. Random, is that an accurate read of the intent of the bill?
I would concur with Representative Winkler.
Representative Holberg, are you concerned that the language might not do what?
I don't know. I have to think about it.
Okay. So I understand we have a number of amendments, and what they reflect is the language of the other bills that we've heard today as amended. So our staff has been psychic in their preparations of the amendments.
Well,
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, credit goes primarily to Mr. Gehring and other folks in House Research who have been constantly updating as we've been doing amendments, and I think we do have a every bill as amended in an amendment form here, so we can put it into an omnibus. So,
as usually, the only reason we look competent at all is because we have fantastic staff.
Yes.
So, we're waiting for the amendments to be collated.
So, an amendment to reconsider one of our prior amendments would not be.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, on a going forward basis, then, all the matter contained in the bills that we've heard will be in House File 695, so we should bring any further resolution of issues to you so that 695 can be amended as it moves.
Madam Chair, yes. I think the point now is to put these amendments on so we have a vehicle bill. I don't think there's any way of getting around. Obviously, this will have to be the big bill, the omnibus bill now, will have to go to civil law. And then in civil law, there will be an opportunity for us and any member of civil law to make any amendment. It gives stakeholders and others in all these matters time to work out any last-minute changes as well. And then, of course, there's always the floor. And keep in mind, Madam Chair, that some of these bills, individual bills, have other stops, which is why we did what we did using the method by which we pass bills individually and put them in the omnibus.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, was the motion on all these to send them to civil law separately? I might make a suggestion that for those that we've decided still need more work, to not put them on your bill yet, so that they can be discussed and with the public, and amendments to those bills be reflected in the civil law committee agenda. As so, in other words, the case of the transit bill, if we throw that on your bill and the amendments to your bill, the public and the people that are interested in Representative Hortman's bill lose the ability even to track what's happening with that.
Representative Simon.
I think that Representative Hortman's bill is a good example. This was its first stop. I don't know whether this is one of those bills. The staff would know. I just don't remember that has to go elsewhere, whether it needs to go to Representative Earhart's committee or, since it's transportation policy technically, but it might. I guess, Representative Holberg, I think the safest thing to do for now is to put these all into the one bill, knowing that if there is comment, and particularly if it gets bogged down in another committee, we can always take it out.
And Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, you're not losing any time here by not shuffling everything in at this point, because all of these bills go to civil, for what I understand is on Tuesday they're going to be moved out of civil. So on Tuesday you could take up the Hortman bill before you move it on, put on the delete all or the fix or whatever, send it to the floor, and then move to amend that bill as amended onto the library bill. If you put all of it together now, you're going to have to amend both of them. You're going to have to amend the Hortman bill to have the new language, and you're going to have to amend your bill if you have the Hortman bill in it. You're almost better to wait to, unless there's, I mean, certainly if there's no problems, questions, throw them on your bill now, but if they're still being worked on, to keep them separate, it makes it a lot easier on Tuesday.
Well,
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do hear what you're saying. I guess my only thought on that is that ultimately, let's say there's a bill that has two more stops. That bill will ultimately be enacted by way of this omnibus bill and not separately. The only reason to let it go separately is so the entire omnibus doesn't have to move around to each committee stop that any one part of it might need. And so those bills, to the extent they're going separately, are doing so to honor the jurisdictional areas of the committees where members of those committees need to hear it. But they will not be, if they're in the omnibus bill, this is the way they're going to be enacted, not there. So I'm a little less concerned about that. I see what you mean about having to amend it twice. I think that's a risk, though, that we'll probably have to take, and it'll be up to conscientious authors and staff, too, to keep track of those things. But, you know, why don't we take up the amendments, and if someone really thinks that it's going to have a number of committee stops and it really isn't wise on an amendment-by-amendment basis to take it up, we can do that, I suppose.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, let me just throw something out there. So then if some of these bills travel individually to multiple committees, we're going to be amending House File 695 on the floor to reflect the work that the other committees have done. Is that your plan, Representative Simon?
Yes, Madam Chair.
My thing is I'm just trying to make Tuesday easier, because you'll have your best language for each of these bills on Tuesday. Amend them on the bill themselves, throw them all together at the end, and sayonara. Where if you set them up in two separate places, then you're going to have to amend everything twice on Tuesday.
Representative Simon.
Well, I have a question. Actually, let me just confer with Ms. Anton for a second. Okay. I just got clarification, Madam Chair, that the omnibus is not being slated for a hearing on Tuesday yet. I don't think it's been scheduled. So we have a little bit of extra time. So it's not necessarily Tuesday. In fact, it's not even been on the Wednesday. Wednesday's not posted yet. Okay. We have a little extra time is the key. So
Representative Simon, your amendment.
We have a number of amendments. Okay, so let me see here. You need a scorecard here.
Representative Simon, you want to start with the A1? It looks like the Freiberg bill.
Yes, A1 is the Freiberg bill.
House File 20.
Right, and this was unique. If you remember at our first hearing a couple of days ago, we didn't actually have it in our possession. Representative Scott had pointed out that we had actually laid it over, and it was never officially referred, so we had what amounted to a long discussion in committee. Here, though, we have an amendment, so we have something to actually act on or move on. So this is kind of an exceptional situation in that respect. But I will move the amendment, understanding that if this goes on and it goes to civil law, we're likely, given the nature of the bill, to have a more extended discussion on this. I concede that. But for
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this the mortgage foreclosure bill that we're talking about?
No, Representative Scott, this is the one on this is the one if you sign up for a snowplow alert about whether Mr. Neumeister can get your address or not.
Right. So I'll move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the A1? Any discussion?
So A1. Are we not fixing any of this then? I mean, this has the effective date problem and the or for informational purposes, so.
Representative Holberg, I personally have an amendment to this language that we haven't, these are all with the messes that they had in this committee that we didn't fix going on to House File 695, if I understand correctly.
And Madam Chair,
Representative
with the
Simon.
Understanding, and this is actually the chief example of all of those because of the quirky situation we had 2 days ago. I totally understand. I think everyone should, and Ms. Anton should too, and Chair Lesh of the full committee, that especially as to this provision, this will have more discussion. There's no question about that in the full committee. So we're not bottling this up never to sort of uncork it again. We understand that there are issues here.
Any further discussion with the A1? All those in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. On the A2.
I'll move the A2 amendment.
This is about coroners. Any conversation about the A2 amendment? All those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Simon, you want to move the A3?
I'll move the A3 amendment.
Remember who's
that was mine. It was
this
three seconds or less.
Okay, any discussion to the A3? All those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A4 amendment.
I'll move the A4 amendment, Madam Chair. This was Representative Earhart's bill on the mileage-based user fees and similar data.
Any questions or discussion? All those in
Madam Chair, I'll be voting no, and I think this is pretty controversial for a data practices omnibus bill.
Any other discussion to the A4? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A5 amendment.
I'll move the A5 amendment, Madam Chair. And this was this was Representative Lesh's bill, the BCA bill.
Any discussion to the A5? All those in favor of the adoption of the A5, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A6.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A6. This was Representative Kahn's bill, I believe, that we just discussed today.
Any discussion to the A6?
I just want to clarify.
Representative that. Simon.
Did we have an amendment to this one? No, we had a discussion. We did not have an amendment. To the Kahn bill.
There were no amendments.
There were no amendments. Okay. Never mind.
All those in favor of adoption of the A6, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. A7, the Norton bill.
Well, this is a question, if I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
This is an interesting issue. It is true, as Representative Holberg said, that this subcommittee over the years, regardless of who's chaired it, has heard issues of medical data and records and privacy, regardless of whether it's Chapter 13. As amended, the Norton bill is now no longer a Chapter 13 bill. That doesn't mean it shouldn't have been before the subcommittee, but it may mean we don't want to put it in the omnibus bill and just let it go on its own. It may be a little easier if we just keep non-Chapter 13 bills, which this now is, as amended, out of the bill. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Representative, or Madam Chair. But there's a possibility that it might get switched back over, right? Or not? It would actually end up being, again, subject to Chapter 13 or not?
Representative Hulberg, do you know
the genetic privacy law was passed in a omnibus data practices bill, I believe. It was a floor amendment. So I'm not sure that we only just have Chapter 13 and omnibus bills. I think it works both ways, but I'm just, I think it can go either way.
Representative Simon is the author of the omnibus bill. Do you want to move the A7 or not?
Well, one practical issue is we've just discovered here that the last page of the A7 amendment inadvertently did not include the Norton oral amendment, which got rid of the Chapter 13 language. But we could, I suppose, orally amend this amendment right now to that effect. Members, I truly don't have a strong opinion. I just thought, for clarity's sake,
you can just
put it in.
That amendment.
No, I'm talking about whether to put this amendment in at all. Because as we're about to amend it, if we do, it won't be a Chapter 13 issue explicitly. But I don't; those kind of boundaries don't matter so much to me. So we might as well, for efficiency's sake, do it. So, Mr. Gearing, could you recommend the oral amendment that would put it in the shape that we had it as a standalone bill?
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, so this amendment to conform to the oral amendment that was adopted earlier today, on the A7 amendment, page 3, line 4, you delete is not genetic information for purposes of section 13.386, and you would insert is not subject to section 144.125, subdivisions 6 to 9.
And Representative Simon, would you like to incorporate that change into your amendment?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon incorporates the change into his amendment on the A7 discussion to the A7. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A7, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A8.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A8, and this was... I can't remember whose bill it was. Oh, this was Representative Scott's bill.
This is the one that didn't get amended today.
Representative Simon moves the A8. Any discussion to the A8? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The A8. Any discussion to the A8? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A9. Mr. Chair, as to the A9, the language, I'll keep working with Representative Hulberg so we hopefully get this in better shape, and then we'll amend your bill and my bill in civil law, hopefully, whenever those bills are heard.
Okay. I'll move the A9.
Any further discussion of the A9? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A11.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A11. This is the MIRA bill, but it does not include at the very end the language that Representative Winkler had suggested that we adopted about the effective date. So, Mr. Gearing, could you restate the Winkler language as would be necessary to make this like the standalone bill?
So, Mr. Chair, to conform the A11 amendment to the effective date amendment that was adopted by the committee earlier today, this would be on the A11, page 3, line 16, delete and page 3, line 17, delete everything before the period.
Representative Simon incorporates that change into the A11. Any discussion to the A11? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A11, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. House File 695 has now been amended by 11 amendments. Are you ready, Representative Simon, to move the bill as amended, be recommended, passed to civil law?
Yes, I'll renew my motion to that effect.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is re-referred to civil law.
Madam Chair, before we go, now that we're off of that bill, I have a motion on the minutes, which should be before you from February 27th, but they need to be amended. There was just a typo at the top. Instead of Committee on Civil Law, it should say Subcommittee on Data Practices. So that would be my amendment. Oh, and then secondarily, on the first line of text, where it says Representative Simon, Chair of Committee on Civil Law, it should say Chair of Subcommittee on Data Practices.
Representative Simon moves an amendment to the amendment to the minutes. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The amendment is adopted on Representative Simon's motion that we adopt the minutes as amendment. As amended, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon, would you like me to adjourn the meeting now?
Please.
Members, the meeting's adjourned.